Welcome to the Online Recovery Area Around the World 2026 event. Next up from the UK and USA, it is with much love and gratitude that the group welcomes Peter M and Donna J to come and share with us. Peter, it's over to you.
Thank you, Bernard. Thank you, my fellows, and welcome everybody. My name is Peter. I am a recovered drug addict. I'm really pleased to be here. I'm pleased that I can say with some confidence that I have recovered, right, from a hopeless state of mind and body. It's for those of us who are questioning and wondering, is it ever going to be possible that I'm going to be free of this beast, this spiritual beast? The answer is an absolute yes. An absolute unequivocal yes. We do recover. I do personally announce myself as recovered because if you had seen me and known me on January the 5th, 2005, and you would have seen what pitiful, demoralized condition I was in then, and you see me now, you would only have one conclusion to draw. And that conclusion was you must have recovered because back then you were dead. You see, and I'm so pleased that when I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our basic text, what we work out, it promises us we will recover. It tells us categorically that the big book contains the information which shows us precisely how to recover. You see, it chooses words carefully. You see, what I have since learned through being around by the grace of God and you guys, I celebrated on January the 6th, 2026, 20 years of unbroken recovery. That is not by accident. That is not because there is anything special and unique about me. It's because what I've learned is I'm an average drug addict. Right? And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step program set out in it was set out specifically for average drug addicts like me. It wasn't set out for people to who be very clever, academically clever, financially wealthy, white, middle-class businessmen. It's set out for average people like me. And if I do what is contained in it, I too will get what everybody else gets. I had to concede to, did I see myself the same as everybody else, or did I see myself as being different and special? And I found out very quickly I'm neither one of them. I'm average. The question I had to ask myself was, how desperate was you? Had you conceded that of yourself, by yourself, you had been a catastrophic failure in dealing with this spiritual beast? And I had to concede to that. You see, my experience is I picked up, well, I probably had my first line of cocaine probably in 1980, 1980. By 1981, I picked up my first crack pipe. I call it, I started sucking on the devil's dick in 1981. I was on my knees. By 1983, I was already at the drug dependency clinic. You see, I already knew Within 3 years of using cocaine, that I was in trouble. What I didn't know is I didn't know anything about powerlessness. I didn't know anything about the malady. I didn't know anything about the allergic reaction. I didn't know anything about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't know anything about being a distinct entity. I didn't know anything about ease and comfort. I didn't know anything about this. I thought I just liked using. I thought I just liked it and the effects produced by it. But I already knew I was in trouble. And here's the thing, is that by 1983, I was already at the drug dependency clinic. And just like it says in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when doctors talk about their limitations in how they can help us to overcome, they talk about their limitations. It was the same when the drug workers, when I told them what I was doing, and they said to me to my face, Peter, we have no treatment for that. We have no treatment for cocaine use. We have no treatment for that. We don't know what we can give you. If you were an alcoholic or you were using heroin, we could give you a substitute medication. Now, here's what happened to me when that I walked out of that clinic, is I walked down the road and I asked myself a few questions. And those questions were, so if the professionals who you presumed, right, were paid to understand your drug addiction, right, and why it was you're killing yourself, have just told you they have no treatment for it, you know you love your child, your children, and yet you can't stop for them. You know. You love your job and your career, but this is damaging your career and you don't seem to be able to stop. You're already suffering physical health conditions, loss of weight, alopecia, all kinds of other stress-related issues, and yet you can't stop for that. That's basically telling you that no human power. I didn't know it in those terms, like we now know once we've been through the program and we understand the spiritual illness and why no human power can do it. I had to just ask myself those four simple questions. When I answered all of those questions to myself, I knew I was in purgatory. I knew I was in the wilderness because, under normal circumstances, most people would respond to those conditions. Most people will stop or moderate their behavior given any one of those four circumstances. I was not able to do that. So, therefore, I knew I was in trouble. Because I looked around me and there was nothing on God's planet that was able to give me the power I needed to stop destroying myself. Well, what a state of affairs that was. What a state to be in when you recognize that on God's planet there doesn't seem to be any answer to you systematically destroying yourself. And with that in mind, I stayed out there for another 22 years. I've got many, many, many examples of powerlessness. You know, I can remember, and for those people who may well be, you know, in there just joining us or coming back from a relapse, I can remember, you know. You see, the way my condition, my illness would speak to me is it would speak to me in my own tone. It would speak to me in a voice which I was familiar with. You see, even if I woke up and I said to myself, I'm not using today because I want to go and pick my kids up. I want to go and pick my parents up. I want to do a good job at work. Even if I said those things, I want to restore my dignity. And my self-respect. I want to be normal and go about my normal business. At some point, it would speak to me and it would persuade me and cajole me, right, to make a little opening somewhere in my day to fit it in. It would work with me and wait for that moment in my psyche where it saw an opening. It would even on occasions cloak the whole thing in, if you have a use up, I can enhance your day. I can help your day go a bit better. I can help you feel a bit better. Find the language you want to use. Look the way you want to look. Talk the way you want to talk. Give you the confidence you want to go. You remember those sort of days, Peter. It might do that. But on the flip side, it might say, I don't give a shit what you feel today, Peter. You're going to use today because that's what you do. You're going to use today because that's what we do. You're going to steal a little bit of ease and comfort, and then you're going to suffer the consequences for the rest of the day. And it's going to convince me that that is a worthwhile deal, despite all my knowledge. And see, this is what I'm contending with. Something that runs through my psyche, through my veins, through my blood, through my thinking, through my mind, that it will convince me. And that's what I'm up against. I've got examples, right, of meaning. With every fiber in my body, that I'm going to pick my kids up from school today. Right? I'm going to get them. Right? Somehow or other, I would have a use up, maybe even a couple of hours before. Because remember, it's told me that it can make my day better, including picking the kids up and everything else. And I fall victim to that use up, and I have that use up. And there are occasions, you see, this is how cunning and baffling it is. There are occasions where I might be able to prize myself out of that crack cocaine den, right, and put the rest of it in my socks and feel as though I'm going about my business. You see, what it's doing to me is it's telling me, Peter, you have some power. But let me tell you what would then happen. It's somewhere along the line, another voice would come in and say, you know what might be a good idea, Peter? Is to go back and finish off what's in your socks. Find somewhere to go and finish it. Because when you finished it, you will then be given back your life. You will then have a clean slate, Peter. You'll be able to have satisfied your beast. Your beast will leave you alone, and you'll be able to get on with your day and do, the normal things like pick the kids up, like have dinner, like go out and see family. Those normal things will allow you to do that. But of course, it wouldn't. Because when I stopped and gone back and taken out what was in my socks and gone and had a use up again, the phenomenon of cravings kicked off. I can't concentrate no more. I can't think no more because I want more. And it would repeat this to me time and time again. Something happened. I've got many examples. I've ended up in hospital. I've ended up with catheters in my private part. I've ended up with needles in me. And all I can think of doing is blackmailing my kids to go to the dealer, pick it up, and bring it to the hospital to me. Many, many exams. And then I discharge myself after taking advice from the doctors who say, if you leave here and you continue doing what you're doing, you'll be on a dialysis machine because your pancreas has given up. I would leave in my boxer shorts and jump in a cab and get back to the front line and score again. So I've got many examples of powerlessness. But you know what? I want to move to the great news because this is great news. I can remember the night, which was the beginning of the end. I was in the usual place that I was in, with the usual crackheads around me talking the usual shit that we all talk, right? All smoking and passing the pipe and all the usual crap. And one of them got up that evening to go and score, and he never came back. And he came back eight, he never came back that night, but he came back 18 months later. And what had happened to him was he got arrested and he went to prison. And when he went to prison, he found the program in prison. And 18 months later, he came back into the trenches. Right. And this is what's beautiful about this when you've got power. He came back into the front line where there were six of us who were all skip rat crackheads. And he sat there and he said to us, "Listen, boys, when you're ready, there's a way out." And I remember thinking it's only a matter of time before he concedes and he sucks on the pipe. And he didn't. And he came back three or four times over the following months. I didn't know the man was carrying the message to us. And I remember him saying to me, "When you're ready, Peter, you look like you are near the end." That's all he said. "I'll be there for you." Fast forward, I ended up back to the drug treatment place. And this time they sent me off to a modern day asylum, which was a treatment center where everybody was mad. Paradoxically, it was where I felt most comfortable. Oh my God. For the first time in my life, I could share with another addict why I was insane and why I did these insane things. And you never blinked an eyelid because you understood the inner workings of my mind. And when I got to that treatment center, he was there to pick me up at the train station. And I landed in the rooms. And by golly, when I got in the rooms, I heard the message. Right? That you can recover, Peter. I heard men sharing their experience. I heard men talking about their shame, guilt, trauma, the missing their kids and all the rest of it, crying. And they said to me, "Peter, do you want what we've got?" And what I saw was a light in their eyes. I believed them because my pal was there. He was in the room. I knew he was one of us and he had recovered. I had to ask myself, was I going to have it? That's all I had to simply ask myself. Did I really think I was special and different? Was I going to fall in and do as I was told for once and stop? I had to abandon a couple of lifelong percent words that I used to use. And the first one that had to go was, "Yeah, but." That had to go out of my vocabulary. The second one that had to go was, "Yeah, I know. You know that one when somebody's trying to tell you something and the first thing you say is, yeah, I know. When I know Jack Diddley, I know shit. That had to go. And then the third one was, yeah, but what if? Wow. Let me tell you something now. This is my experience because I had had such a beautiful kick in from drug addiction, alcohol, crack, and heroin gave me wipe the floor with me. I was ready to let go of those things. And the minute I let go of those three icy word statements that I used to hide behind, the minute I let go of them, I felt the power enter me. I knew I was about to embark on something revolutionary. I knew it. You said to me at the beginning, Peter, you need to get God in your life. You cannot be God. And I can tell you what happened to me 3 days into the nut house is I got on my knees. For the first time, I in earnestly asked God. I didn't even ask God to help me stop using. I just asked God to help me stay around you. I just said, God, please don't let me go. Don't let me leave. The next day, I was twoed up with a man who was in the same room as me, and he brought a piece of crack cocaine in and he asked me, did I want any? Now, remember, I've been on my knees sucking the devil's dick for 25 years. That man asked me, did I want any crack? And for the first time in 25 years, I paused for a moment and I said to him, I think I'll pass. Now, I had to ask myself after that, I thought, did you just say that, Peter? Where did that come from? How did you just refuse crack? What happened? And I realized there was one thing and one thing only I had done. And that one thing was I got on my knees and I earnestly invited God in. That's the only thing I had done different. And of course, when I invited God, because you know God is not rude, God will not come to anywhere that he's not invited. I invited God in and God just cloaked himself around me. That's where the power come from for me to say, I think I'll pass. When that happened to me, I knew from that day onwards that God was real. I knew he was real and I knew he cared about me because he had just saved me from a bullet. He had just helped me dodge a bullet. He had to be real. I was told, and I remember I opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a little three-letter word where it says, we beg. It's the only time the beautiful book uses the word beg. It says, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough. I took that on. I thought, for the first time in your life, Peter, you need to be courageous. You need to lift the stone on this. You need to let whatever's under the stone be have some light shone on it. It's been in the dark for too long. I was told to get a sponsor and to go through the 12-step program. As outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I read the doctor's opinion. I found out what was wrong with me. I found out why it was I couldn't go and get my kids when I wanted to. I found out why it was I couldn't do my job properly. I found out why it was I kept making the supreme sacrifice and tearing down the structure I'd built. I found out the fact. I found out. And then I went through the rest of the program. The shame and guilt and all the rest of it I'd been carrying for decades. The program showed me a way in which I was going to get rid of that. You see, what I've realized is that I was told early on, a week in, when I was defrosting from all of the shite, the poison mine, the poison chemicals. I was defrosting, and I was told by a man who was 25 years clean and sober then that if you're able, Peter, to cultivate an attitude of gratitude, you will not use again. That's what I was told. I was told by people who were not therapeutic about things. It came straight from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were very clear and precise. He said, cultivate gratitude. And I remember thinking to myself, what does that mean to you, PR? And what it meant, it reminded me of the farmer. If we think about the farmer, if the farmer wants a good yield, a good crop, each season, he or she has to get out onto that field early on and open up that soil. He has to do it at the right time, to the right depth. He has to have the right quality seeds. Those seeds have to be sown at the right time and the right distance apart. Those seeds then need nutrients. They need fertilizers in order to sprout. Right, it then has to close that soil up, and that is his piece of the work done. But here's the great news, and here's the second half. The second half is that he has to believe in a power greater than himself, because he cannot control the rain, the wind, or the sun. So therefore, he's got to do his very best on the ground, and then turn to his higher power for the rest. You see, so my interpretation of cultivation was based on that principle. And that's what I've done ever since, is I've done my bit on the ground and I've turned to my higher power for the rest. And you know what it's like, don't you? A farmer sometimes gets a really good yield or he gets a poor yield. That will depend. But either way, he's still got to keep doing the same thing. You see, what I've learned, our promises are so beautiful. And even after 20 years, I still am in love with this. You know, it says things like, we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. What a promise for a confused drug addict! What a promise. It's telling me that, Peter, after you continuously practice this, you'll see it coming. You know, for anybody who understands or follows boxing, we know any boxer who wants to survive a bout needs to be able to be flexible and bop and weave. Any boxer who stands flat on their feet is going to go over. You see, when I practice the 12-step program, I learn and I speak to God. I learn how to bop and weave. I can see some of the stuff coming now. It doesn't whack me from the flank and knock me over. And even if it does, I come back. Because my feet are firmly planted in God's soil. Which means I have good roots. They go deep. You see? I don't live in fear. I don't live in fear of relapse. You see, because what I've learned is if I repeat tomorrow what I did today, that kept me clean and sober, based on what I did yesterday, means I'll get tomorrow what I got today. It is as simple as that. You see, what I've come to accept is that when it talks us to us about principles over perfection, I understand deeply what that means. Is am I trying to live by the principle of love, understanding, tolerance, forgiveness? Right-sized ego deflation. Am I living by those principles? Because if I am, I'm going to be well. All will be well. Oh my God, let me tell you something now. My experience is I'm having a renaissance, if you can't tell, with this program. It is the only thing that I've seen that never stops giving. Never. Unlike when I would go and pick up a bit of crack and a bit of heroin and a bit of alcohol, and the first thing in my mind is they are going to run out. Before I've even used them, I'm thinking about them running out. This is the only thing that never stops giving. Wow, what kind of deal are you going to get like that? What kind of deal is there going to be that is so infinite rather than finite? Wow. All I can say to you is thank you for educating me. Thank you for loving me. Thank you for shoring me up in my early days and now. Thank you for re-educating and passing on the critical information that those professionals were not able to give me in 1983. Can you see how uniquely placed we are? What special information we carry? Wow. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Pia. Beautiful to hear you, brother. Donna, over to you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Donna, and I am a recovered alcoholic and an addict. I'm so glad that I came here from the beginning. Because I didn't know, like I just show up. Birdie asked me to share, and I showed up, and I didn't realize that this was a fundraiser, if for lack of a better word, so that there can be representation at the conference for the online Cocaine Anonymous meetings. And thank you, Cameron. I don't know if Cameron is still here, but to hear the history of CA, my sobriety date and my clean date is August 5th, 2000, and I came through AA. I didn't know that CA existed, and I'm very grateful to be a member of this fellowship because I get a chance to share my entire story. I could not talk about cocaine in AA because I respected the singleness of purpose, but I have done cocaine. I started drinking, but I did cocaine. In high school, I graduated high school in 1974. So, cocaine was always part of, I started sniffing and then I wound up smoking it. It's interesting how I looked at myself as an addict. I've had a number of wonderful teachers, and my current sponsor is a member of Cocaine Anonymous, and I was going through the big book, and he asked me a question. He said, if you were going to be on an island and you could only pick up one thing, would it be alcohol or cocaine? And he saw me thinking and he says, I don't want you to think. And I realized, like, wow, which one would I take? And so I went through the book, and I went through looking at alcohol and cocaine. But I got to tell you, there was some fear that had cropped up because what if I wasn't an alcoholic and I was an addict? And I started crying because if I'm not an alcoholic and I'm an addict, do I still go to AA or do I stop going to AA? And I shared it with some people. I'm a firm believer of the things that make me fearful and doubtful and anxious, I usually share it so that it stops growing inside of me and festering and being bigger than what it is. And I was facilitating a workshop at the time, and I shared with them that I was about to go through the work again to look to see if I was an addict and how much fear that was creating. To say the least, I went through the work and I realized that I'm an alcoholic and I'm also addicted to cocaine. But see, for me, I'm willing to go to any length. I know it's what happened to me on August 5th, 2000. Like I said, I was sniffing cocaine. I'm from New York City and we did a lot of partying. There wasn't a party that didn't have a bowl of cocaine out. And I'm talking about going to A-list parties at the time, like Studio 54. I'm even before Studio. That's how older I am. And it was fun. It enabled me to drink more once I realized, okay, wait a minute, I don't have to black out because the first time I drank, I blacked out. And so I knew the way to control the alcohol was with the cocaine. And so I became an after hours girl. I loved after hours. I think I knew every after hours below 59th Street in Manhattan and some in Brooklyn. And then I was introduced to freebasing, and the people that were freebasing back then were usually dealers, people that had the money to afford it. And because at this point my problems were starting to pile up, because when you drink and you do drugs the way I do, you conveniently like stop paying your bills on time, like you don't pay your rent. Or back then we were using checks. I would put the check in the mail, but I wouldn't sign the check because that gave me like 4 days to figure it out. And so I would constantly go to bed like shaking, like figuring out, okay, like how am I gonna like manage, like how am I gonna beat the game? I was always trying to beat the game. And I found that smoking crack, or at the time, see, I thought it was like this elite as I was freebasing. Like it took me a long time to say the word crack, but after all, I couldn't avoid the fact that I was a crackhead. So even then I wanted to be this great big such and much smoke in the pipe. And it was a perfect drug for me because I wanted to stop thinking. Like I didn't know how to deal with my life. And you take a hit of that pipe and no thought goes in and no thought goes out. And it was a perfect drug for me because for a moment of time, and the moments of time I'm talking about, like 3, 4, 5 days, I'm just sitting here like just numbing because I don't want to think, and I don't want to end it. I don't want to end it because I don't want to face reality. I was living at home with my mom and she didn't give me the key because she didn't trust me, because eventually like they catch on. Like she caught on that I was waiting for her to go to work so I could come home and shower and rummage through whatever I could take so I can go and get more drugs. And even when I didn't have a lot of money, this thing is such a beast that I would have $20 in my pocket and I would convince myself that that was enough for another run. I mean, are you serious? $20. And see, if for those of you that know anything about New York City, I was living in Queens and I was going to Harlem. That was a journey, and I was tipping out with just $20. And of course, like it was hell, with only that little bit of money. And so that went on, and at that point, like I wasn't even working. When I was sniffing cocaine, I was able to go to work. It was some of the roughest days of my life, but like it says in More About Alcoholism, I needed to prove to you that I didn't have a problem. And whenever I tell this part of my story, I envision myself getting off the elevator, and I knew that it was going to be a rough day, but I was also a manipulator. Like I knew to look for the decision makers in the office, and I knew who to cough in front of. Because if I coughed in front of somebody that had the ability to send me home, that's what I did. And so I started drinking and drugging at 18, and now I am 44 years old. And that's when I walked home on August 5th, 2000, and I was surrendered. I tried to commit suicide 10 years prior to that. But it's like my mind still had some things for me to try. Like I hadn't done a geographic yet. And I look back and I realize, wow, this thing has so much power over me that even trying to kill myself, I couldn't see that maybe there's something wrong with you, Donna. I was still convinced that I was going to try to figure this out. And so when August 5th rolled around, I was too exhausted to try. I don't know whether my ego was tired of feeding me the lie, or I was tired of feeding the lie or listening to the lie. All I know is that a power burst upon me that I had never felt before. And I knew in that moment that I never had to drink and drug again. And to the point that it was such a real moment for me that when my mom opened the door, I told her I was done. And I had never said that. See, I had gone to an outpatient program. And see, I knew all the snappy one-liners. I knew how to sit there and say, I'm Donna, I'm here for today, because I was still drinking, but I wasn't smoking. And so I always knew how to dope fiend. I always knew how to get over and get by, but I was just so exhausted. And I talk about how I got on the block. It was the people that threw me out of that crack house that day. The transit worker that let me on the train, the bus driver that let me on the bus, all of these people were responsible for me to get on that block. And, it says we discover spiritual principles. I was always very grateful for the token booth clerk and the bus driver, but I began to understand that that was compassion. And I also get to see that, God just wants us to be in position because we never know when we're going to be used. Those two people had no idea what was going to happen to me the rest of that day, but it was their compassion because they could have easily said, get out of here. Because I can only imagine what I looked like that day after being up for 4 or 5 days. And you know what it's like when you smoke in that pipe, you don't want to get up off the table. So if I was going to wet my pants, trust me, I was going to do that. So I don't know what I smelled like, what I looked like. And I think it's real important that I talk about what I was like. I think we all need to talk about what we were like, what happened, and what we're like today, so that you guys don't think that this is who we always were. Something happened in me. And that's why Ninth Step Amends is so powerful, because the last time folks saw me, I wasn't looking anybody in the eye. And to be able to go back and look people in the eye and admit the wrongs that I've done, they get to see the power of God in and through us, in spite of us. But see, our ego still wants to run the show and wants us to be afraid. But I couldn't even see in the ninth step process that there's so much more than me being afraid of what people are going to think. It was about God showing people what a life dependent upon God looks like. So I believe what happened to me on August 5th, 2000 awakened me enough to this new life that all of a sudden I was able to hear. I couldn't hear before. I did a lot of listening, but see, when I just listen, trust me, I'm already arguing in my mind what you're saying. I'm already can't wait to speak to let you know how much I know, because I was this great big such a much. But I started to be able to hear. And I know for a fact that I was placed in front of people that had what I wanted. Are you willing to go to any length to get it? And I knew that I've always been looking for something. I always felt that something was missing, but I didn't know what it was. But I saw it. When we live our lives in the dark, living our lives like we're dying, when we're in the dark like that, the light is very bright. And so I saw the light. I saw the light in Loretta. I saw the light in Rashid and in Sydney. I also knew that I didn't know anything, because when I was around them, I just listened. And I remember being in the car with them, and we'd be going to meetings, because that's what they did back in the day. Because I came in person meetings, and I didn't have a car, so they would pick me up, and I just sit in the back of the car and just listen to them. And I'm like, who are these people? Like, who are they? And like, how are they alcoholics and addicts? But the way they're being just seemed so like beyond what I could ever imagine I could ever be. And Loretta and Sydney had a big book workshop on Harlem. and they were taking addicts and alcoholics through the Big Book. They had done some work with Joe Hawk and carried the message to those of us that were in New York. And I don't know how I found them, because there was a lot of people in New York City that was not going through the Big Book line by line. But it's so crazy that of all the alcoholics and addicts, I met other travelers. I met other people that were interested in going home. So my what was I think even more important than Loretta and Sydney was the fellowship of seekers that I was meeting. I was meeting other people that were willing to go home. And that's not what we were saying at the time, but something was compelling us to do this deal. And I remember we didn't have recordings back then, right? So Loretta and Sydney will be going through this book line by line, and I felt like I was looking down her throat, and I'm trying to catch everything. And I'd go to meetings, and I'd bring my Big Book to meetings, and I'd have my pen. And you know, it might have been Peter Marinelli sharing, and I'm listening to Peter, and I got my Big Book. I remember he said, I forgot what he said now, but I remember, and I remember what he said. I heard it in the book, and so I went to the book, and so my Big Book also became the place that I can share, I can record when I heard people sharing in meetings, because we didn't have the recordings, right? And all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, this thing is what they gave me was a way for me to be of service to other people. So now I'm sharing in meetings, and I've got 2 years, and I'm saying I'm a recovered alcoholic, and there's not a lot of people that are saying recovered alcoholic, and I'm getting really nervous because people are coming behind me and they're sharing and they're saying, well, we don't recover, we always are recovering. And I got like 2 years, and thank God for my elders. Thank God, because a person said, Donna, this is not about you. Maybe you're making them feel uncomfortable about what they're not doing in AA. And he said something so powerful. He said, think about how they treated the carpenter. And I thought about it, and I said, man, the carpenter who spoke truth, they crucified him. So why am I being so concerned about what people are thinking about me? I know that there's something happening to me as a result of the work that I'm doing. And so I started to meet other people, and we're going to different boroughs, and we're going to different Big Book meetings, and we're going to conferences. And now people want me to work with them. And I'm like, Loretta, what am I supposed to do? I didn't finish the book, and they want me to take them through the book. And she said something that just relaxed me. She said, Donna, if you're a page ahead, you can take them through because you know more than they do, even a page ahead. That might sound crazy for some of you, but for me, that made me feel okay. And that's what I did. I started taking people through the book. If I had any questions, I knew enough recovered alcoholics that were on this path, I would ask them. And what they would do, they would always take me to the page in the book. The answer is in the book. And so I think it was Peter or Kwame who mentioned about getting the key to the Big Book meeting. And I remember I came, because I was in treatment. I come out of treatment. And the thing is, when I was in treatment, I didn't have the luxury of calling a sponsor every day because I didn't have phone privileges. So my reliance was never on a sponsor. It was just the way my journey went. And all I had was that Big Book workshop on Saturday, and I raced there. I raced there. But what was happening, it was the people around the table. I was starting to connect with people that were willing to, that we were put together with these teachers, that we were given ourselves permission to finally discover what's wrong with us. Because I couldn't tell you what was wrong with me. If you said, Donna, why are you drinking and drugging the way you're drinking and drugging? The best I could say is, you just don't understand. Oh my goodness. So I gave myself permission to understand. I didn't understand that I had no power control and I had no choice whether I would drink or not. And I realized this might sound crazy for some of our new friends, but I'm glad I didn't have the choice, because because I didn't have the choice, I wouldn't be seeking God the way I'm seeking God. Because I would have said, you know what? This thing is getting too crazy. I'm gonna stop drinking and drugging. I'm also grateful that I was told that I suffer from an illness because the less power I had, the less control, and the less of a choice, baby, my behavior was matching that. The more I drank, the more I drugged, the more a liar I became, the more unaccountable, the more irresponsible, the more. And now I'm hating myself and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm the worst human being on the planet. But I'm so grateful that I discovered that I suffer from an illness, and that gave me some hope. Because there isn't any illness that I don't know that can that you don't go and find treatment for. And I realize that I've got to look at this the same way I look at any other illness, that there's a solution and there's a treatment. And that gave me the hope to continue on this path. What also made me realize that something powerful had happened. See, I started to look back at August 5th, 2000 from a different perspective. See, because my mind downplayed August 5th. It made it seem like it was no big thing. I don't realize, wait a minute, I'm not obsessing over alcohol. I'm not obsessing over drugs. I took it in stride. How do I take something in stride like that? I remember I had come home on a pass. And I found a bag of crack in my purse and I held it in my hands. I'm not kidding. The room got bright. It got brighter than any light bulb. And at this time, my mom had cleaned up the room because I was so slovenly. I didn't even know slovenly was a word, but I was that. I would come in and I would pass out in a coma. I didn't clean, I didn't do jack. But my mom cleaned up that room. And I remember I looked around and that bright light and looking at that room, I was able to see where God had placed me. And I remember I took that bag and I threw it down the toilet. I was never able to do that. I don't share that a lot. I don't share that a lot. But even that was enough for my thinking mind to push that easily aside. And to focus on the things after the dash. I'm powerless over alcohol, but after that dash, the unmanageability, I don't see that I'm right back where I've always been, full of fear, don't feel good about myself, am too concerned about what you think about me. Even though Rashid would say, Donna, get off the people, I didn't know how to get off the people. And he would say, don't worry, this is not about catching up. It's about catching on and you'll catch on. And I just was willing to do what they told me to do. I remember right before I was about to make 9-step amends, I was around Rashid and some of his sponsees that had been on this journey, which is interesting. We start on this path, but the path just leads us to a now. Like we're just in the now, in every now. And they would say, you know, when you're serious about making amends, God will have people appear. And even though it sounds far-fetched, I couldn't help but not believe them because of their behavior, because of there was something different about them. So I was willing to believe, and I had my own experience when that happened. I'm at 59th Street subway with a whole bunch of people, and somebody calls out my name, Donna Jonas. I turned around, and it was somebody that I was trying to find that I couldn't find. So that's how, and number of experiences like that enabled me to go from willing to believe because of what I saw in you all to having my own experiences that I began to have faith. I knew after step one that I could not rely on my thinking. It's interesting how powerful that big book was for me because I couldn't see everything that they were saying in that book. Like, how come I couldn't see that every last time turned into another next time? Like it was like it was new information, even though they were talking about my life, but I couldn't see my life until I got in this book and I was like, wow. And just like Fred, like I'm not gonna be on guard for something that says, oh, a couple of cocktails with dinner would be nice. I'm not gonna fight nice. I don't fight nice. And so, thank you. I'm so grateful that I was able to see this illness from a perspective that my thinking doesn't let me see it. So I do want to talk about online, and I don't know where I'm going with this share, but online is so powerful because COVID, I was living in Brooklyn at the time. And see, what I didn't know was that the liquor stores were considered essential stores and stayed open during COVID, because I'm thinking, damn, where are people getting their alcohol from? Because I know they're not, they can't stop drinking. Well, thank God the medical profession understands that alcoholism is an illness, because those liquor stores stayed open. Because can you imagine the hospital full of COVID patients and then alcohol withdrawal? No, we got to keep them drinking. And so I started to go to online meetings, the ones that I knew, the New York meetings, because that's where I was at. And I heard a lot of people still talking very fearful. And then I was able to see that there's a lot of people that may not be in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and just in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was so much fear. And so I found the Bronx Big Book meeting. And it was like 40 people in there. And the reason why I picked it, because it said Bronx and it said Big Book. And I noticed the difference in the shares. People were sharing from a place of a solution. And then all of a sudden, I realized how many messengers were in position for God. I saw my friend Ralph in this meeting. It's like what Loretta and Sydney were doing in New York City and Harlem, Ralph was doing in LA. And it's like, and then I'm sharing, and then I get introduced to Cocaine Anonymous, which, trust me, I never knew I would be in this fellowship. Be okay and not know. To be able to go down this path and not knowing, giving up control, which is really hard. At least it was hard for me, because I thought I had to protect myself. I had to protect myself from you, because all my life I was so, my mom always yelled at me, so I always felt like I had to be prepared, because I never knew what she was going to come at me with, and that's how I lived my entire life. I didn't know what was going to come at me. Living my life feeling separated. I think step five is one of the most powerful examples of connection with another human being. We're willing to share the things that we thought were going to come back and hurt us, be judged by it, and to sit across from another human being. And I had two powerful fifth steps. I did fifth steps with two men at different times, and it was very uncomfortable as I was walking with my sheets, and all I could hear was the word all. I have to share all, the word all. Oh my God, I gotta share all. And in both times, I felt the presence of God. Both times I was rendered powerless and I couldn't speak, and I felt a warmth rush over me, and to the point that I just wanted to stay in it. I didn't want to leave it. But I can't live off of yesterday's experience. It's like li living yesterday's ham sandwich. It's like eaten and it's digested, because I'm always going to have a new experience where my thinking wants me to be afraid, wants me to be doubtful. There's some things in my life today that I can feel the hum of some things that I have no clarity on, but they're not anything that I need to bring into the now. And so I've gotten to a place that I know that eventually there's some things that may show up, but it doesn't mean now. And I'm the awareness of I can watch TV or somebody will say something and it will trigger the fear, and it wants to become the thing that I focus on. And I'm grateful that I can pause, because nope, that's not what I, it's not anything that I can do about it now. There's also times that I realize that I can walk right into an objectionable behavior, whether it's anger, whether it's impatience. The thing that's different about these times now is when I am behaving that way, I'm aware of the behavior. It's like having this out-of-body experience, and I think that's a way that God teaches me. I had called and was talking to a medical staff person, and I heard myself be very impatient. It was like watching myself be impatient because I wasn't getting the information that I wanted, and that I was able to relax. I can't tell you enough about my gratitude for the online presence, because I wouldn't have met many, many messengers. And when I'm asked to do these kinds of workshops, I like to be a part of the workshop because I like to be fed. Because each one of the people that shared before me fed me. So thank you very much. Because I think we get fed so that we can feed. I get to see that it's this whole thing that we're all connected. And I always say it's like it's 159. And I've learned not to be nervous, because at this very time, there's other people doing the same thing I'm doing at this time, doing the same thing, carrying hope. So instead of me thinking, oh my God, I got to share, can I look to see, Donna, you are being used by God along with all of his other messengers to bring hope to people. And so I get to see that I'm not this great big such and much. I'm one of many. And I get an opportunity to bring hope, because we are purveyors of hope. What a miracle. What a miracle. And the thing, the pain and misery and despair that brought me here, because I carry a lot of pain, I carried a lot of hurt, that got me here, but that's not, I'm not experiencing that. It served its purpose. It got me here. But it's not what, it's not a part of my story. Like I carry these stories like a sack. And I love in step six when God says, now that if I've let you see the things that are blocking you from living a purposeful and impactful and useful life, let me take those from you and let me give you what I need for you to have so that you can be of service. And then we get to practice these spiritual principles. And you know, I'm very grateful for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've been introduced to spiritual principles all my life. I just didn't see them practiced. My mom's telling me to be patient, yet she's crazy. So I'm not getting, you're telling me how to behave. I was told to be nice and to be fair and to share. But I see people throwing each other under the bus, and I learned if you said something to me, I was throwing you under the bus. Well, she did it too. And so that's how I'm raised. But I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I see spiritual principles being practiced in real time. I see you're accountable when we share 10 steps. The willingness that we do in 9 steps, like all of the work that we do, the honesty, the open mindedness in the shares. I got like a minute in a share. We're being honest, open. We're being helpful. We're being of service. All of the principles that we're sharing in a 10-minute share, 15, 20, 30, 40-minute share. It's like we move, the ego gets pushed aside, and God is presence. So I want to thank you guys. I think I'm done. Purdy, am I over? Thank you all for allowing me to be a part of this amazing day. And for those of you, do your 7-step tradition so they can send the representative MJ to Texas, because online, I'm grateful for online. I wouldn't have met you guys. Thank you.